I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is January 10th, 2010. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today we have part two of Life After Death, an interview on Larry King Live hosted by Jeff Probst. Part two begins. Jeff Probst says, "You're watching Larry King Live. I'm Jeff Probst, sitting in for Larry tonight. We're joined by Dr. Jim Tucker, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia. He is a child psychiatrist, and he has studied over 2,500 cases of reincarnation memories in kids. He's also the author of Life Before Life. And here to explain reincarnation memories and what he's learned from years of research. You heard the story of James last week, a young boy who thinks he was in World War II. Is this a similar story to what you researched with kids?" Professor Jim Tucker replies, "It is. I haven't studied all 2,500 cases, but at the University of Virginia, we've been studying them for nearly 50 years. And what we have found is that kids from all over the world report very similar things at around the age of 2 or 3. They start coming out with these stories about how they lived before. Some of them give a lot of details, like James has. Some give much fewer. But it's a very similar phenomenon. It takes place in places where there's a belief in reincarnation, but also in places and in families who have never given it a second thought before." Jeff asks, "In some of these cases, the kids have similar scars to the people that they are reincarnated from, don't they?" Wait, hold on. Your original premise was that a soul reincarnated into the body of a little boy. Now you are adding that the soul also brought with it a scar from the original body and put it on the kid? Tucker says, "That's right. Several hundred of them have had birthmarks or birth defects that match wounds, usually the fatal wound on the body of the previous person." Wait, hold on again. How could a fatal wound, such as a large bullet hole, leave a scar? Once the victim dies, his body would not produce scar tissue. So when the victim dies, his soul continues to heal the wound, producing a scar on the body that the soul no longer has, and then it takes over a kid's body by booting out the kid's soul, which goes somewhere, and then makes the scar appear on the kid's body in exactly the same place as where it formed on the previous body possessed by the soul. I'm going to need a few minutes to scoop up the cerebral spinal fluid that I lost on that one. Tucker continues, "And what we have done with some of them, Ian Stevenson, who started the work, has done most of this. He was able to get autopsy reports from a lot of the people whose lives the kids seem to remember and to match up just how well the birthmark or the birth defect matches with the wounds the previous person had." Jeff Probst says, "Were you able to chart the time between, death and reincarnation?" Jeff, take this advice. Do not quit the survivor gig. Tucker answers, "Well, it varies. The average time is only about 15 or 16 months in our cases. So for the kids who seem to come back with intact memories, the time span tends to be very short. James is an exception to that. We're talking about 50 years. We have others like that. In general, it tends to be quite quick." Jeff, if nothing else, this interview speaks volumes about the value of a PhD. It is no guarantee that the one who acquires it will also acquire logical, rational thinking skills. Jeff says, "A study is one thing. Believing in that study that there's a result is another. Has this convinced you these are real? Tucker answers, well, I think if you look at the strongest cases, that they provide pretty substantial evidence that something has gone on here, that there can be this carryover of memories and emotions that seem to survive after a body has died and then carry on in another child. Jeff, like I said, a PhD is no guarantee. Jeff says, all right, do you talk about life after death? Why some people don't take it seriously and why they should when Larry King Live returns. Jeff, I never thought I would actually look forward to the phrase, when Larry King returns. After the commercial break, Jeff Probst says, near-death experiences. Hundreds of people claim to have them every day in the U.S. alone. We're talking about how and why this occurs. And there are people, of course, who don't believe in them at all. Dinesh, you talk about in your book that life after death, it's sort of the elephant in the room. We're all fascinated by it, but nobody really wants to delve into it. Jeff, maybe you've been doing Survivor too long. In America, 85% believe in God and in life after death. Dinesh says, the atheists and the skeptics are always saying, give us some experience. Give us some empirical evidence. Dinesh, that wouldn't bother you so much if you had something to give them. Dinesh continues, we can't talk to dead people. Dinesh, we have tons of psychics touring the states, raking in fortunes for doing just that. Are you saying they are all liars and fakes? Are you disputing the miracles of the renowned Sylvia Brown, the illustrious John Edward? Are you besmirching the reputation of the eminently honest James von Prague? Besides, as a Christian, you pray to dead people. Since when did you become a skeptic? Dinesh continues, we can't go to the other side of the curtain, but the near-death experiences are probably the closest thing. There are now thousands of them. They occur all around the world. They have a bunch of ingredients that are very similar. The sense of being drawn through a tunnel, of seeing a bright light, in some cases meeting dead relatives or friends, feeling the presence of a celestial being. For a while, what the atheists would say, well, this is a kind of mind game, a little bit like if you took hallucinogenic drugs. You'd have weird dreams. That's true. If you give 100 different people hallucinogenic drugs, they wouldn't have similar or the same dreams. It's the uniformity and universality of the near-death experience that makes you have to take it seriously. It's not so easy to write it off. Dinesh, if they were identical, you would have a point. The fact that you yourself admitted to a whole array of differences, such as being drawn through a tunnel, seeing a bright light, feeling a celestial presence, and meeting friends and relatives, shows that the experience is anything but universal and uniform. Jeff Probst says, Sanjay, when you look at the study, 2,500 cases is a pretty decent sample. Where do you merge the medical world and the spiritual world? Dr. Sanjay Gupta replies, well, it's interesting, you know, listening to both Jim and Dinesh. With regard to near-death experiences, if that's the beginning of your spectrum, I think scientists try and explain a lot of things away scientifically. The tunnel, for example, that potentially can be explained away by a lack of blood flow to the back of the eye. You start to lose your peripheral vision, see a tunnel, bright lights, same sort of thing. Even the seeing of deceased relatives, perhaps. That is a very cultural thing, for example, in Western cultures. In Eastern Africa, people who are having near-death experiences tend to see things that they wish they had done in life. That tends to be their cultural thing they have. Having said all that, what's so interesting I wanted to tell you and Dinesh, was that when I was researching this for a long time, I thought I was going to explain it all away physiologically. but things that I heard and validated and subsequently believed convinced me that there were things that I could not explain. There were things that were happening at that moment, that near-death experience moment, that simply could not be explained with existing scientific knowledge. So I think that's where you have to put the spirituality sort of answer and some of the reasoning on the table when it comes to these sorts of things. Sanjay, creationists will recognize that argument as the God of the Gaps argument. It is a logical fallacy in religion, and it is still a logical fallacy in medicine. Deepak Chopra chimes in. One very important phrase there, existing scientific knowledge. I don't think science and spirituality are things that are enemies. You know? Science has always looked at the world objectively. When we're looking at consciousness, it is our consciousness that's looking at consciousness. Thanks, Deepak. We can always count on you for a deep, insightful, meaningless piece of gibberish. Dinesh D'Souza says, the researcher Elizabeth Kubra Ross had reported years ago that some of her parents who are blind have had near-death experiences, and now there are studies of blind people who have had near-death experiences, and they are able to describe the number and gender of people in the operating room, the kind of instruments that were used, often the color of the drapes, things that they wouldn't ordinarily be able to know. Dinesh, the listener should understand that these types of arguments are used to force an opponent into submission. How? By lying. Of course you cannot reply to such nonsense, because it isn't true. If anyone could prove that they actually did what was claimed above, they would be famous beyond compare. Dinesh continues, now again, we should look at this skeptically. Dinesh, if you ever looked at anything skeptically, your skull would shatter. He goes on, we should see if there are natural explanations for all of this. My point is, the weight of the evidence, when you balance it out, is that there is something going on. See, if the atheists are right, Dinesh, hold it. What has atheism got to do with any of this? Can't you even keep your head straight long enough to remember which debate you are in? Dinesh continues, these kinds of near-death experiences shouldn't be rare. They should not exist at all. Dinesh, why not? Scientists don't doubt the existence of near-death experiences. They doubt your interpretation of them, that people have returned from being dead, and the concept of reincarnation, because there is not yet any evidence in support of either claim. Dinesh continues, what the near-death experiences are telling us is that even when the body breaks down, you are clinically dead. Your heart has stopped, or there's no measured brain activity. Consciousness and experience seems to go on. It's kind of like saying, I've turned the car off, taken the key out, but the car is still running. Dinesh, the same thing happens when you cut the head off a chicken. It may still run around for a while before all its functions shut down permanently. Now the host, Jeff Probst, says, got to take a break. A man died on a football field 7 years ago and came back to life. His incredible story in 60 seconds. Okay, after the commercial break, Jeff Probst says, I'm Jeff Probst from Survivor, sitting in for Larry King tonight. We have the ultimate Survivor story now. Bob Shriver was refereeing a high school football game 7 years ago when he went into cardiac arrest, died, and was revived. Dr. Sanjay Gupta spoke to him. Sanjay says, what did you experience? Did you have pain? Shriver replies, no, nothing. Dr. Gupta says, Shriver was in cardiac arrest on this very field during a high school football game. A team trainer armed with the school's brand new AED, or automated external defibrillator, shocked him back to life. Shriver says, it was scary. Dr. Gupta says, Shriver was choking up as he showed me the video that day. Then he started to talk about what he remembered. What were you experiencing when everyone was seeing this? Shriver replies, It was very peaceful. It's very serene. And it's extremely, extremely bright. I mean, it is bright. And I saw a place that I was supposed to go. I saw that halo. And something was saying, go toward the halo. My comment, it sounds like he saw the movie Ghost, starring Patrick Swayze. The fact that his brain replayed that when he went out is not a reason to sell the Jeep and join a cult. Dr. Gupta says, he says he was dead for 2 minutes and 40 seconds. My comment, we know the brain can survive much longer than that before suffering irreversible brain damage. I don't think reputable doctors would call time of death after only 3 minutes. Jeff Probst says, powerful stuff. Bob Shriver will tell us more about his near-death experience when we return right after this. Then after the commercial break, Jeff Probst says, Bob Shriver says he died and was revived. We're talking about what happened to him when he went into cardiac arrest and came back from the dead. Bob is the co-founder of the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Association. What do you remember of that? Bob replies, Not much. When it happened to me, I was just following the quarterback on a rollout, and I took two or three steps and took a half a step and started to lean. And that's all I remember. Jeff Probst says, No pain? Shriver replies, No pain. I had a heart attack the night before, where I had some minor pain and jaw pain, but I was unaware of it. It was during another game. I was unaware I was having a heart attack the night before until after the fact, when I had the symptoms and I more or less recognized it. Being the macho guy I was, I refused to do anything about it. My comment, the listeners should note the euphemism, macho guy, replacing the true description, stupid idiot. Shriver continues, but when I went down with sudden cardiac arrest, I had no pain, no nothing. I just blanked out. That's all I remember. Jeff Probst replies, Sanjay, obviously you know Bob from doing the story, but you also explore the idea of near-death experiences in your book. Is this a similar story? Dr. Gupta replies, yes, yes. The stories are very similar in terms of what we hear people who have sudden cardiac arrest and other things as well, especially, again, in this country, very similar stories. The point I was trying to make earlier, a little bit, is this idea that as part of what they experience, though, they... Jeez, how does this guy even follow himself? I'll back it up a little. The point I was trying to make earlier, a little bit, is this idea that as part of what they experience, though, they couldn't have possibly had that experience explained away completely by the brain or explained away completely physiologically. Some of what happened to Bob and what he told me, I couldn't explain it. That's what was so interesting. My comment, God of the gaps, he can't explain it, so it must mean an eternal soul exists. Now Dinesh D'Souza chimes in again. There's a psychologist, Susan Blackmore, who has advanced a theory that's widely discussed now. It's called the dying brain. The idea is that when your brain goes into shutdown mode, it generates these kinds of experiences. Bob is a kind of walking refutation of this theory, for the simple reason that if all the people who have had near-death experiences are living among us, they drive to work, they function normally. If Bob's brain died, how did it reconstitute itself? How did it repair itself so he's now functioning normally? The dying brain theory, I think, doesn't hold up to scrutiny. Dinesh, the dying brain theory doesn't say that shutdown mode is irreversible. It depends on how far it has progressed. After 2 minutes and 40 seconds, Bob's brain did not have to reconstitute itself. The brain, like all other body parts, does repair itself. As for functioning normally, these people rarely function normally after such an episode. The only theory that doesn't hold up to scrutiny would be yours. Jeff Probst says, let's get Michael back into this. Michael, if Bob had been hooked up to your machines, what would they have shown? Michael Shermer replies, he wasn't dead. You started this hour off with Sanjay Gupta explaining we can't say somebody's dead at one given moment at a particular time on the clock. That's not how it works. It takes 2, 3, 5, 10 minutes to go through a dying process. The ref wasn't dead. He was in a near-death state. We know from Dr. James Winery from the U.S. Air Force, he has documented over 700 near-death and out-of-body experiences in pilots going through G-force loss of consciousness. It's simply apoxia or oxygen deprivation to the cortex. Jeff Probst replies, there's a little bit of semantics going on there. We made the point of saying that the old way of saying you're dead is now being revisited. But there's still the idea that death is a process. And I think what we're saying here, Deepak, is if you go with that, that Bob was in the process of dying. Dinesh D'Souza replies, I think also there's a larger physical framework here. You know, 100 years ago, if you said life after death, if you used particularly religious vocabulary, heaven, hell, the idea of having a resurrection in modern physics, none of this made any sense. Space and time were presumed to extend definitely in all directions. People said matter, we know what that's like. We know how that behaves. Bodies die. What is there to live on? Today, a scientist will talk about hidden dimensions, multiple realms, other universes. Do we know if these other universes exist? Well, not a lot, but we know that if they exist, they have laws totally different than our universe. Dinesh, as always, your attempts at logic defy the laws of logic. How can you prove that they have laws totally different than our own universe if you don't even know they exist? Michael Shermer says, it's important to remember that before we say something is out of this world, that we first haven't gotten a worldly explanation. You said earlier, Deepak, that I can't explain everything naturally. Okay, so what? That doesn't mean there's a supernatural force. That just means you can't explain everything. The fact you called consciousness the hard problem is right. The fact that we don't have a cogent theory of consciousness doesn't mean that altered states of consciousness are something spiritual or supernatural. Deepak replies, I don't believe in anything supernatural. When did we use the word supernatural? Deepak, it is irrelevant whether or not you use the exact word supernatural. The fact that everything you believed is based on belief in the supernatural is sufficient to understand your position. Dinesh adds, either there is life after death or there isn't. It's like asking a caterpillar, is there life after being a caterpillar? The caterpillar might say, no way. I can't conceive of what it's like to be a butterfly. But that's just part of the natural order. You don't need supernatural. Dinesh, can you construct a single thought without using an analogy? The reason why you can't is because you need false analogies in order to mislead listeners. You cannot confront a question in a straightforward manner because you lack evidence for everything you believe, so you are forced to try to trick people with misleading analogies. Your last analogy was as pathetically misleading as all your others. Since your analogy assumes insects can conceive ideas, I will go along and ask, why do you assume a caterpillar would not be able to conceive of life as a butterfly simply because it hasn't reached that state yet? If it saw other caterpillars turn into butterflies, then why wouldn't it be able to conceive the idea? Deepak states, by the way, there are traditions that say the in-body experience is a socially induced collective hallucination. We do not exist in the body. The body exists in us. We do not exist in the world. The world exists in us. Deepak, once again, science is trumped by traditions. It is amazing what passes for evidence in a mind that requires none. Michael Shermer states, "That doesn't work for me." Deepak replies, "I know it doesn't work for you. Who's the one that's talking to me right now?" Jeff Probst interrupts, "Let's get the one that's here in the room with us, Bob. Weigh in on this." Bob Shriver, the man who had the heart attack, says, "I'm not a medical person. What they're talking about is over my head. All I know is in our organization we have many, many survivors who belong, and they tell the same story or basically the same story. I did witness something. It didn't go as far as some members did because they were dead, clinically dead, if you want to put that term, much longer period of time. Thanks to the medical we have today where they can keep them alive than I was." If that is how he talks when he functions normally, he might as well have stayed dead. "You hear the stories they tell, and before all this happened to me, I was not a believer in this. I have to tell you right now, I am now a believer in this." Jeff Probst says, "More spirited debate about a very spiritual matter, or maybe not, right after this." Then they break away to a commercial. Upon returning, Jeff Probst says, "Welcome back to Larry King Live. I'm Jeff Probst. Why can some people die and still go on living? We've been exploring the life and death topic with some experts. Deepak, if there is life after death, then does it matter how you live in this life?" Deepak answers, "I think just because there's life after death doesn't really change anything in the deeper sense. But it does because you know when you die, you're not going to be a better person than you are now. You're going to carry on the consciousness that you have now." Deepak, "And you know this how?" Jeff Probst says, "There's no hope for me?" Deepak says, "If you do have, live beyond hope. Hope is a sign of despair. You have to live in a state where you want the truth, okay?" "Wait, Deepak, time out. That last one caused me to blast a mouthful of vanilla pudding all over my keyboard. Give me just a minute." "Okay, I'm back. Deepak, if you have to live in a state where you want the truth, then I'm afraid you have an awfully long road ahead of you." Jeff Probst says, "We'll do therapy later." "You tell him, Jeff." Deepak says, "If there is life after death, the quality of your life tomorrow depends on the quality of your life today. So the best way to ensure a great future for you is to be present now and live it the best way you can, with loving kindness, compassion, joy at the success of others, peace, and equanimity." Michael Shermer says, "Deepak, that's the smartest thing you said today. I have to say, I completely agree with you. Whether there's an afterlife or not, that's precisely how we should live our lives. We are in agreement." Jeff Probst says, "Let me ask you this. Would a near-death experience of a serial killer be different from that of somebody who's lived?" And here he's interrupted by Dinesh D'Souza, who says, "It would be. In fact, initially, the near-death experience seemed entirely positive. But now there have been extensive compilation of nightmarish and hellish near-death experiences, which have shocked people into transforming their life. I think here's the point. If there's no life after death, and we reflect on that, then in a sense we are passengers on the Titanic. We can rearrange the deck chairs, we can turn up the music, but the whole ship is going down." "Reality really sucks, doesn't it, Dinesh?" Dinesh continues, "On the hand," I think he meant to say on the other hand, "if there is life after death, then we have a reason to believe in cosmic justice." Dinesh, "And that, of course, is your God." Dinesh says, "We will believe that good will be rewarded. Evil will be held accountable." Dinesh, "That is not true. According to your Christian beliefs, you can be forgiven for the most horrible sin, as long as one chooses to worship your God." Dinesh continues, "We have a sense that we can face death more bravely because it's not the end." Dinesh, "If that is what you need to face reality, then keep it." Dinesh continues, "It's a gateway to another life." Dinesh, That's provided you are able to kick out the spirit that is inhabiting the little kid whose body you are trying to take over. Dinesh says, we can teach morality to our children. We derive a sense of meaning and significance in our life, which is part of this larger framework. Dinesh, eternal life is what removes meaning and significance in life. If you are going to a better place, why do you care what happens in this life? Dinesh says, so I think life after death, even if there's residual uncertainty, I think the preponderance of the evidence supports it. But even if there's residual uncertainty, it's good for me to believe. It makes sense. Dinesh, if what you believe made sense, you wouldn't have to rely on faith and false analogies. Jeff Probst replies, Sanjay, is there any unethical aspect to the process of death has begun, and you're going to stop it and bring it back? Dr. Sanjay Gupta replies, absolutely not. I mean, that's what doctors in the medical community are trained to do. It does raise questions of what do we really know about death? What's really happening? What is death per se? I don't think we're very good at determining that yet. I mean, even within hospitals, the idea of brain death, which Deepak sort of talked about, it's, for the most part, a clinical exam. So in one hospital, they may give you a slightly different answer versus another hospital, which may not seem like a big deal, except the fact we're talking about death here, and it becomes a very big deal. It's not at all unethical to obviously try and reverse that process. Jeff Probst says, Michael, we've spent an hour going back and forth. Deepak is going to be looking for you somewhere in between wherever you are and wherever we are right now. Have you taken anything from this? Michael Shermer replies, I do think that the preponderance of evidence argument is the way to go, because it can't be proved or disproved like in a court of law. I think we have to look at the preponderance of evidence. In my case, I tend to still be skeptical. In Dinesh's case, he goes the other way. Jeff Probst says, Deepak, would you say to Michael, you prove it then? Michael interrupts him, well, the burden of proof is not on me. I'm not making a positive claim that there is an afterlife. Therefore, I don't have to prove it. I'm just saying, let's keep an open mind. But we don't know. Why not just say, and now Deepak interrupts, that's the first sensible thing he said. Let's keep an open mind. Deepak, you wouldn't know a sensible thing if it slapped you across the face. Michael Shermer says, no, second sensible thing. Remember, I agreed with you. Deepak says, okay, second thing. There's a difference between cynicism and skepticism. I'm glad that he's a healthy skeptic. Cynicism is a risk factor for sudden death from premature heart disease. Deepak, you better hope that one of the risk factors isn't blatant ignorance, or else you might as well start making funeral arrangements right now. Jeff Probst ends the show with this comment. I wish we did not have to wrap this up, but we do. Thanks to Larry for letting me sit in the chair tonight. It was a pleasure. Jeff, glad you enjoyed yourself. Wish I could say the same.
Are you ready, Bruce? Start walking.